Okay, I'm going to cut you off right there, and you'll have to come to the meeting to learn more. So Dave, I'm going to ask you to introduce our guests.
And okay, I'm going to keep it real short, except I want to back up for a second on why you guys are all here. Rick got a hold of me and said, hey, do you want to do something in December? And I thought it was his casual lunch crowd. Little did I know I was signing up for an AES chapter meeting. So I kind of sucked us all into this whole thing. Luckily, Marcelo and Tim are going to represent. Tim is our VP of engineering. Tim's history goes all the way back to the start of NXT, which is a certain term that I think many of you know in the audience. And he was there when they poured lots of money into that. He can tell you a little more about how it was organized. But he's been there from the start since they commercialized this technology. And there was a lot of money spent, a lot of people with very, very impressive degrees. There's a lot of science involved with all this, and that's some of what we want to touch on. But we also wanted, and then there's Marcelo Riccelli, who's our CTO. And Marcelo and I and Scott and a few other people go all the way back to early Mackie days, and actually I go back to audio control days with Rick. So there's this intermingling of all these things that people have done. Marcelo has a background in live sound and studio recording. He owns Chameleon, which is a studio component company that makes rack gear for microphone preamps and other things. But he also is our CTO of Tektonic. He ran RCF engineering for 4 years over in Italy. Has designed transducers, speaker systems. Actually, when we finally do the demo, the subwoofer that's sitting here is a double 12 that Marcelo designed. So those would be your two presenters. And so is that good enough?
Perfect. Welcome.
There you go. Go, go. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Dave.
Here's a five. I'll sit on the side for now.
Right. Well, thank you all for coming. I know it's a cold and not wet night, luckily. But I'm going to talk to you a little bit tonight about the kind of two key embodiments of the technology that we've been working on. But all of it falls under the umbrella of bending wave loudspeakers. And as Dave said, my background originally was, I'm a physicist originally, and I went to work for NXT in the very, very early days. NXT had a bit of a bad reputation, and a lot of that was due to the business model and the fact that they were selling a lot of kind of multimedia type speakers that didn't really capitalize on the technology. So there were a lot of kind of things that were not done very well that led to ultimately NXT's demise, but also perhaps getting a bit of a bad reputation. One of the reasons that, you know, I kind of came here to work with Tektonic is, you know, we were doing it correctly. The way the engineers at NXT had always envisaged the technology being employed, this is exactly what Tektonic was doing, and so it made perfect sense. But as Dave said, you know, all the work that was done at NXT, a lot of the, you know, the research, science, math and physics that was done there, they had over 40 mathematicians and physicists trying to understand how this stuff worked. And just as a little bit of background, it came about from the Ministry of Defence in the UK trying to make fighter jet cockpits quieter. And composite panel technology was totally in its infancy in those days. And the Ministry of Defence was taking these composite panels, putting them in the cockpit of aircraft, and the idea was that it would absorb the noise and make the cockpit quieter and a better environment for the pilots. It actually got louder. So the Ministry of Defence were like, okay, this clearly is not what we wanted, but there may be a commercial application here. And a chap called Dr. Keith Heron, who was the original guy at the Ministry of Defence who developed this, he was on the original patent, and that was licensed to NXT. And NXT went off and kind of spent probably like £100 million researching and trying to commercialise the technology. So here we are today. And again, it's you know, Tektonic has taken this technology, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it, and hopefully answer some questions and explain a little bit about the science that's gone into it. So we're all familiar with the traditional Pistonic loudspeaker. generates pressure waves through pistonic rigid body action. And we can see here on the bottom left, here's the kind of basic equation that describes pretty much how a conventional speaker operates. On the right-hand side, we have a tectonic bending wave speaker. This is actually an embodiment of a DML. This is actually from my FEA model of what you're going to hear a little bit later, vibrating at a particular frequency. And then below that, you can see the kind of the fundamental equation, differential equation that describes how a panel vibrates. And this is very, very telling. So on the left-hand side here, the highest order differential is a second order function in displacement. On the right-hand side here, when we talk about the DML, we actually have a fourth order differential equation. And that comes down to the bending wave and the shear waves and everything that are travelling in the panel. But clearly you have a more complicated system. And obviously because it operates in a modal regime, again, this is an area that's kind of most engineers, acoustic engineers, would go, you know, modes and everything.
So I think it's a pretty good place for me to interject. Check. So when Dave Firestone and Dave Stokes and the guys at Tectonic, they approached me with looking at this panel to see if what I could be doing in terms of being able to help them out from an engineering perspective, I didn't have any understanding whatsoever of what you're looking at right now. That physical representation, that FEA representation of what's going on, along with the mathematics, no idea. My background was completely the left side. And I can tell you that, you know, we can do today with the tools available, depending on the application, we can design a loudspeaker within 4 hours, including right down to the material used for the voice coil former, the material used for the cone itself, the material used for the dust cap. We can figure out the suspension geometry for the surround, the suspension geometry and material we want to use for the spider, and we can get pretty close. We get that sample in-house, we do two measurements, that's probably another hour and a half of work. Look at the results of those measurements, look at the Teal small parameters, and they basically say, wow, I can change this parameter, I can change this parameter, and really get close to what I really want. And then do listening tests, and we can make decisions about the material of the cone, we can make some other issues, you know, we can develop very good opinions about the harmonics of coming off the cone, and then noise and everything else. The one on the right, is impossible to do that way. This I had to learn. It took me 2 years to wrap my brain around this, and I'm finally to a place where I can sleep at night. Because it's, you approach it from a, you know, I've been doing this since 1986, and been involved with audio, you know, amplifiers and speakers and stuff, and it is so counterintuitive. And in terms of how it behaves and how it works, and you have four conventional motors, which are, say, the drivers, magnetic circuits, voice coils, that's all conventional. But there's so much more involved in terms of material science, in terms of how the panel behaves. It's so fundamental to getting the modal behavior of the panel to work in your favor. And that was number one. It took me a long time to understand. And then how to measure it. So I was more involved in the sort of like, and the practical application of this technology that we had in our hands, and more focused on the fact that when I was at front of house, for example, I wasn't able to get what I wanted out of the old panel. So how do we move to changing the character of the panel itself so it has more of a behavior consistent with what we want to achieve at front of house? We need it to be much more upfront. We wanted it to have completely different character. It had very much a hi-fi character when we started, and now we've changed it. One of the things that we also focused on was that when I spoke to Tim for the first time, we said when it came to the panel, we didn't want the panel to, you know, be the panacea for the world's audio problems. It's really not. It has some very, very interesting characteristics, and it provides some advantages, but there's no way we're going to get 60 hertz out of this thing. It ain't going to happen. We don't have enough linear excursion. So our focus was taking this particular embodiment, this panels over our heads, and really focusing on performance above 120 hertz, 110 hertz. But again, going back to the mathematical part of it, when you start understanding the complexity of the differential equation that you're faced with, it's massively more complex than being able to figure out how a conventional loudspeaker works. So this is the first step in the trying to dig into what it is that it does, and how, you know, how the technology behaves, is that it is much more complicated, and it belies the eye, you know, because when you look at it, you go, it's a flat panel with four motors. It's not. So this is kind of a first step into understanding what's going on.
Yep. and as Marcelo, you know, was kind of leading us down here as well, is, you know, one of the key differences that we should talk about at this point is the fact that the panel is what's known as a dispersive medium. So we're all familiar with sound in air travels at the same speed regardless of frequency. In a DML, in a panel, the wave speed is proportional to frequency, or the square root of frequency, actually. So you have a different frequencies travel at different speeds within the panel. And that is key to a lot of the kind of really important properties that we get, acoustic properties we get from this object. So tonight I'm going to talk to you about the two key embodiments of the technology. What we have up here is the DML, the distributed mode loudspeaker. And we're going to talk a little bit about how it works. The part of the clue is in the name. The second one is what we call the BMR, the balanced mode radiator. The BMR is much more like a conventional drive unit, and you drop it into a box and you tune the low frequency alignment just like you would do for any conventional bass driver. Except for the fact that with the BMR, we kind of get rid of the whole issue that a large format cannot do high frequencies. And with the BMR ideas, we can actually do high frequencies with wide directivity all the way up the audio band. And that currently, the largest unit that we've done this with is about a 4.5-inch drive unit. And when you look at the KA2 point for a diaphragm of that size, the directivity should be significantly narrowing by about a kilohertz, maybe 2K. And what you find is that we get extremely wide directivity all the way up to 20 kilohertz. So we are overcoming one of those limitations, the power beaming issue. So I'll go into a little bit more detail about the BMR shortly, but we'll start off with the DML. So as Marcelo was mentioning as well, designing this object, it is possible to design. We have design tools. We have software that was developed by NXT, in-house software. It's called Pansys, and it's a full design suite for designing a DML loudspeaker. And some of the key things you need to think about, the geometry of the panel is probably one of the most fundamental, because what you're trying to do is interleave the modes. So when I talk about a distributed mode loudspeaker, the key to it is distributing the modes evenly across the bandwidth. Sorry, I don't have a fancy graphic for this, but what I tend to use is my fingers. If you had a square panel, then say the panel was isotropic, so the stiffness is the same in all directions, and it's square. The mode set in one axis, in one direction, is the same as the mode set in the other axis, because it's a square. And so the modes would sit on top of each other, and you'd have a very jagged frequency response. But if you choose to interleave your modes following the design rules, you essentially go from this to this, and you then have a very, very smooth response. And that's what the DML is all about, using lots and lots of modes and interleaving them as smoothly as possible.
So this is, as a loudspeaker designer, it gets totally, like, crazy. Because as a loudspeaker designer, you don't want any modes. Modes are bad. And especially, you know, when you start talking about high-frequency devices, you want all the modes to be way above some high-pass position. You know, so, you know, 3-inch compression driver, as an example, a 3-inch compression driver, you can probably, it gets modal right around 9K. So anything you can do to move the mode up is really helpful. So that's why, you know, you turn to exotic materials, all sorts of stuff. Mm. So now you're getting into the world where modes are good. And that was really, really difficult to get my brain around. And the most difficult part about measuring this loudspeaker, and we'll talk about this in some detail, when I first put it, that panel, a standard panel, into the anechoic, I had to send Clio, and then I had to borrow an AP because I thought mine were broken or not calibrated correctly. Because I was measuring somewhere between 10 and 11 dB lower distortion than anything I'd ever measured. And it's completely modal. So those two things just make no sense to me at all. Because modes were basically, you know, the fundamental source for, you know, distortion spikes, you know, which are clear, very clear, when you start measuring stuff. But no, doesn't work that way. It drove me crazy. And the fact that you were English was really difficult, too, for me.
Yeah, I still have issues with that, and I'm seeing someone.
injections, right?
How many modes are you trying to manage?
So in the DML that you're going to hear later, probably close to 100, if not more, but certainly dozens and dozens and dozens of modes. Generally, yeah. You want to be operating it in a highly, a modally dense, modally active region.
Lots
of modes, lots of interleaving modes.
Can you make a definition of mode just for the lay people for what a mode is?
Sure. So, I mean, a mode is a, like a standing wave, essentially. So when you think about a room mode, it's the wave, the acoustic wave that fits within the two parallel surfaces, and you have a first mode, and then you have another harmonic of that mode, and so on and so on. We have exactly the same thing in the panel to do with the geometry of the panel. Thank you.
I have to say that is counterintuitive, the fact that you have so many modes, but you see, you put hundreds of these modes in this, so you're kind of like an interpolation. You're kind of flattening out the response based on many, many points rather than...
Yeah, so this is the next challenge. How do you measure it? Because if you got hundreds of modes and you just decide to do what we do with a studio monitor, get on axis, run a measurement, and you go, wow, that measure's pretty good. And then you put this thing in front of you and you go, whoa, that's ugly. So you'll see what the setup that we have in the anechoic to be able to make multiple off-axis measurements, interpolate all that data, and then create really significant... A significant representation of what that speaker is doing, because you have to average it out over the entire, off act from 180 degrees this way, say, into the room.
Intuitively, it seems like it'd be a very lumpy,
You also have to get your brain around that you're with this stuff. You're not only are you measuring in a fixed location relative to the panel, but if you start as you start getting off axis to the panel. You start seeing changes in the impulse response, which are very weird, because the impulse response is made up of all of those modes doing this. So the impulse might look really jagged, which again is completely counterintuitive. You look at the impulse and you go, "That shouldn't sound good, should not." But as you move off axis, and you really start magnifying the impulse. You see that the location of those peaks is actually moving too, because now you're moving around the panel and you're at a different physical location in terms of distance from all these points that are emanating, an audio waveform. So it's like, oh man, okay, sorry, now you can go back.
No. But as we'll see shortly in a couple of slides, that's actually one of the key properties of this device is the fact that it's diffuse. It's predominantly diffuse, I should say. And that comes down to the fact that as you measure it at different angles, it completely changes every couple of degrees. And we're used to measuring speakers where it generally changes very gradually as you move around. And that is part of the reason for that is the coherent wavefronts that are coming off a conventional speaker. It's radiating coherent, kind of hemispherical wavefronts. Everyone's very kind of related in phase. And with the DML, it's like having an array of multiple tiny little sources, all moving at slightly different phases and what have you. And so that gives it a degree of like temporal and spatial decorrelation. And that's the key to how it works in a room. And again, we're going to look at this shortly. And again, it comes down to the fact that we've built all these anechoic chambers for measuring our speakers. That's great. And you put a speaker in one room and you listen to it and it sounds fantastic. And then you take it to your friend's house and you put it in his room and it sounds terrible. But in the anechoic chamber, it measured good and you kind of balanced it a little bit in a couple of different rooms. But it's, the room is so important to the sound of any speaker. And what we find with the DML is that it's much more benign to different environments.
And there's one more thing that you'll find. So when you say that we make a measurement today of a DML, and we measure at every 5 degrees, and so we're making 39 measurements in this space. And we're going to make 39 measurements at 37 different positions, so that we can have like a half sphere. We can take all that data, we can crunch it, and we can end up with an average. And what I've never seen in a conventional loudspeaker is that I do the same thing for a studio monitor or for a PA or for a box, is that say, well, looks like you're starting to get degradation on the horn right around 10, 12K, and it's starting to kind of, every 15 degrees it's falling off 2 dB or something, some really nice smooth roll off. You're looking for like no interference between this source and the woofer at the crossover region. Everything looks really good. Now you put that speaker into a room and you measure it, the room dominates the behavior of the loudspeaker. And depending on the mic position in the room, you're going to get a different result. DML doesn't work that way. DML, when you measure it in the room, now starts behaving like that average curve, that average power response that we generated in the anechoic. It starts averaging like that. And it doesn't, and even when you're putting the microphone now on axis, because now you're no longer just measuring the speaker, you're measuring the speaker plus the room, plus the reflections and plus everything else, it starts behaving more like the average response or the average power response, which is, again, completely counterintuitive. And you don't get a lot of the standardized effects of the room and on top of the loudspeaker, which include all the echoes, which include, like, say that you can generate all of the RT times and you can generate some intelligibility stuff now in models. We're not seeing that in the DML because that energy is not phase related.
Yep.
Yeah. If you go to a low enough frequency, then does it start to behave?
Well, yeah, there is a place where the thing starts to behave more like, stops behaving like a piston.
Yes, I mean, if you start from the low frequency end, it starts off, its zero mode is like is the piston mode. So it will resonate, mass on a spring, and it will drive like a piston, except it's a piston with the surface area of something like 6 12-inch drive units, which again may be the reason why the distortion was so low.
But we're still limited by excursion.
Yeah.
So it's not, again, it's free air, it's not loaded, so you don't have anything behind the panel to help you. But there is definitely a position where you can see where it stops working like a piston and now starts becoming modal.
So again, that's a key design parameter, the boundary conditions. So we have various ways of holding it. So there's one of the things that we do is we generate a drive map. So the most critical modes are probably the first 10 to 20 modes, because they're the ones, because they start out at the lower frequency end as being more spaced apart. And as you go up in frequency, they cluster together more and more and more. So what you're really concerned about initially is the low order modes. So we generate a drive map. So we actually look at a plot of the nodal lines for each mode, and we overlay them for the first 10 modes. And what you find is that towards some of the edges, those nodal lines cluster together. And a nodal line is a line of very high mechanical impedance for that mode, because it's a nodal line. There's no motion there, so you're putting energy into something that doesn't want to move. And that's a perfect place to hold the panel and not disturb its modal structure. Conversely, where the nodal lines are sparsely positioned in the panel, those are good drive points. And again, so that's one of the ways that techniques we use to figure out, A, where to hold it, and then where to drive it. And then the holding it can be a combination of somewhat harder, maybe sort of rubber blocks, kind of sandwiching the panel on either side, just very, very gently kind of holding it, but with, movement allowed, but not so much. And then perhaps on other more kind of lengthy edges of the panel, we put a softer foam that's more damping, higher damping properties. And again, we adjust the amount of that to get the right ratio of damping to kind of modal activity in the panel.
So you try to basically not match the impedance, but try to not get an impedance which gives you your modal
yeah, we kind of engineer the panel to give us an ideal modal structure, and then we don't want to then destroy that by clamping it and all that kind of stuff. So. Yes. Yes, totally. Yeah.
Can you drive the shape of the panel designed by your target modal responses? Mm-hmm. I know that using your software, you can take a shape and you can predict its modal responses, but mm-hmm. can you actually go the other way around?
I think in theory, yes. I think in theory you can, but there's other complexities that come in, which perhaps you could account for as well. But often we use an anisotropic panel. That's actually desirable for a number of reasons.
Can you define that, please?
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. So an anisotropic panel, and that's the case in the panels you're going to hear tonight, is that the stiffness is much higher in one direction compared to the other direction. And of course, that changes the mode structure. Mm-hmm. And actually, what we find is for an isotropic panel, there's an ideal aspect ratio of X and Y. But by changing the stiffness, we can have a non-ideal aspect ratio, that physical, visual aspect ratio that's non-ideal, but actually, to the waves, it is ideal. And that's because the stiffer directions, the waves travel faster in those directions. So if I can sketch on the whiteboard for a moment. So if we have a... If we had an isotropic panel, then and you excite it here, then the waves are going to travel out as circles. For an anisotropic panel, where the stiffness is much greater in one direction, you get it does this. And so the waves will see these edges first before they see these edges. So to the waves in the panel, it looks like this panel is actually narrower this way.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah. So to go back to your original question, could you work backwards from the target modal response?
Right.
Possibly.
I'm only asking because you've got a rectangle here. It's a very simple shape. Are there more complex shapes that can actually give you?
So this is where the world changes. So this world is completely different from like a standard loudspeaker world. It's most of this has to be done in FEA, and most finite element analysis. And so these are basically physical models, physics. You know, the physics of all of materials involved to obtain the modal response that you want. And so much more time is spent on the materials themselves used to make this loudspeaker than there is on like the conventional things that we would be spending on designing a tweeter, a mid-range, or a mid-bass. There's lots of knowns. You know, there's 80 years of R&D with a normal loudspeaker, and the manufacturers come to us, and we can get pretty good properties for, you know, cone materials and, you know, behaviors of all it, and then actually doing the magnetics. But this is where it gets totally just like goes off the deep end is when you start doing what you're describing, which is trying to get into shapes which are non-conventional. And we're doing quite a bit of that because our company right now is kind of split up into two groups. When half the time we're spending developing products that are branded but with the Teutonic brand and trying to figure out our way through the pro audio marketplace and where are we going to go. And half of it, and the bulk of our time is spent with OEM and figuring out how to put these things into, you know, Alexa products and Google products and car audio and that sort of stuff.
When you say different shapes, do you mean different shapes of flat panels, or are you talking three-dimensional as well?
Three-dimensional as well.
Mm. Awesome.
Yeah, we're looking at a project came to us last week. We're looking at a curved panel, curved in one direction, and that pushes the stiffness up in that direction. If you start curving it in multiple dimensions, it gets tricky to model. I mean, you can do it, obviously.
Is the panel a uniform material?
So the panel that we use at the moment in this structure here, it's a composite panel. So it's got a carbon fiber skin, and in the middle is a honeycomb structure made of Nomex. So it's highly stiff and very lightweight.
But that doesn't vary at different points.
No. I mean, you can do that. We have experimented in the past. Not so easy. Sorry?
More modes.
Potentially. Or you can change things, like you can change the drive point impedance. So we used to experiment with this using foam core panels, which much easier to compress them and to compress them in a mold and create, you know, a thicker or a denser region here and, you know, less dense edges and stuff. The problem is that the foam cores generally tend to have a very, very low shear modulus. And what happens is the shear waves in the panel are very inefficient radiating energy, acoustic energy. So if you're putting energy into the shear wave field, you're wasting your energy. So we tend to look for core materials that have a very high shear modulus, and that gives us much better output at the high frequencies.
And the fun part from our R&D perspective is that we get to dive into a lot more into things like carbon fiber. And we, around being in the Northwest, you know, we're dealing with some guys that have been doing a heck of a lot of consulting in completely different areas and applications of this stuff. But I'll give you a great example. We're looking at working with some carbon fiber, which is on the area of 0.001 inches thick, so 1/1000th of an inch thick fiber that we can lay up in a mold, get the structure that we want, and then add resin to this thing that will now give us the Young's modulus approximation of beryllium. And we want to do it with carbon fiber. So, and you know, these guys have never been asked the question. Could we get a Young's modulus that looks like beryllium? What's that? You mean like BE? Really? Yeah, it's important to us. Let me come back to you. Yeah, it's possible. You're like, cool! Because we're using it to make speakers, and these guys are, you know, literally either making, you know, motorcycle frames or doing stuff for Boeing, making wing structures, you know. So it really kind of starts changing the way you look at the material science part of it.
And that's good. And the thing as well, we have to really remember here is not to get too kind of down that rabbit hole of the math and the physics. And we have to always return to the fact that what we're making is something that people want to listen to. And so the materials that we're looking at are not just being judged on their Young's modulus and Poisson's ratio and all this kind of stuff, but we want them to have the right timbre. And that's equally important. And again, that's probably a function of the damping and different kind of ratios of different material properties, but we want something that sounds natural and sounds nice. And you know, you can take the same core structure and put a polycarbonate skin on it, and it sounds awful. The BMR, which I'll come back to shortly, the more kind of drive unit looking one, we tend to use a paper skin with a paper honeycomb core. That sounds particularly nice as well. So we are keeping in mind that this is actually something that people have to listen to, as well as not just a mathematical exercise.
Let's get past this one.
So something I've mentioned already is the fact that the DML is predominantly a diffuse source. So we can see that effect when we look at the effect with an interaction with a boundary. So we have a source with no boundary, waves spreading out hemispherically, as we all know, very nice. Then we add a single boundary up on the left-hand side here. And you can see for a point source, like a conventional cone speaker, you get a very, very strong, what we call a cone filtering interaction due to the reflected energy interfering with the original outgoing energy. And that happens because the two wavefronts are so strongly correlated with each other that when they meet, they interfere very strongly. And so in a room, you get hot and cold spots depending on different frequencies and different locations. For the DML, because it's diffuse, and there isn't a strong phase correlation between these wavefronts, when they meet each other, they just kind of, it's almost like they just kind of pass through each other, and there's no strong interaction, and that's kind of what you see here. I'm going to show you some measurement data that backs this up in a moment as well. But this is absolutely key. The diffuse action is absolutely key to this, because if you took a panel like this, and when we sell this to people in churches and concert venues, you know, we're talking about 165 degrees of output across the range in all directions. Someone putting that into a church, something like, would go, you know, somewhat reverberant space, would just go, ah! You know, it's going to put energy in places I don't want, it's going to ring the room, all kinds of stuff. But the key thing is that because the energy is diffuse, it's not driving the room the same way. And so you don't have those same problems.
It's sort of as below, so above, where you have the field is multimodal and the room can be multimodal.
Yes.
Because they reflect each other.
The room is multimodal below the Schroeder frequency. So At lower frequencies where you have room modes, yeah, absolutely, you have a strong modal structure. And as you go beyond what the Schroeder frequency, the modes become so complex and there's so many of them that it kind of just becomes a sea. And we have the same thing with the DML, exactly. The DML has a low frequencies, has a very clearly modal structure, and as you go up in frequency and you have more and more modes, it becomes almost like a sea of modes. And
it's a multi-excitation.
Yes, and you're kind of coupling those two things together. Absolutely.
Is that transition point the 110 hertz that you were talking about, or is it higher than that?
The crossover.
No, where it becomes modal.
Ah, so it's around about 200, that sort of region, yeah. Okay. Sorry, just gentlemen.
With conventional, like, two-channel stereos, usually you'll have a sweet spot that you want to be in. Mm-hmm. How does that game change when you have a couple DML speakers like this?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So, firstly, the first thing is when you know we're talking about this uncorrelated kind of random behavior, you're like, well, how do I get a stereo image in the first place? So the clue to that is to look at the impulse response, and what we find is the DML panel acts like a mechanical resistor. Its impedance is predominantly resistive, so it's not like a mass-controlled object. So with a cone, you're trying to move a mass, and that has inertia, and you're pushing it backwards and forwards. With a mechanical impedance that's predominantly resistive, you're just dumping energy in, and that energy is going somewhere. So what you find is, so going back to the impulse response, what you have is initially you have a very, very fast spike. It's really sharp and really narrow. And that spike is then followed by what we call the diffuse tail, which is the predominantly kind of diffuse energy. And that spike contains everything that you need to give your ears the cue it needs to get a location. So you can get the stereo effect, and you'll hear it shortly. But what you also find, and this is an area of active research for us, is, you know, we tend to find that the stereo image is more tolerant in the rooms. Different locations in the room, you still get a reasonably good stereo image. It's not just confined to this narrow kind of sweet spot. And part of that may be down to the fact the way the DML interacts with the room fundamentally. It may be down to something else. I have to say I don't know the full answer to that at the moment.
The time alignment problem that excites the precedence effect is the dead center of that thing. Mm-hmm. So since you destroy that, what you do is you only have the amplitude cues. Mm-hmm. So you'll get a much wider. I would suggest that's what's happening.
Interesting.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but
yep.
It means there are certain kinds of effects you could not render, but you'll never, ever, ever see this in standard stereo recording.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, yeah, that could...
No. Talk about this later.
Sure, sure.
There's a reason I think this.
Okay. Interesting.
How much radiation is off the back?
So, if you did nothing to the back, it would be pretty much the same as what's coming off the front.
So it's not damp. So
we physically damp these.
Does it behave like a dipole with a Pistonic dryer, or is it different?
We kind of loosely term it a diffuse dipole. So when it's modally active, you don't really get much cancellation front to back. But at the very, very lower frequency operation, where it starts to behave like a piston, then absolutely, it cancels front to back. You can put it in an enclosure. And absolutely, we do that sometimes when it's going to go up against a wall, for example. You want to control that rear radiation more carefully. We tend to leave the rear open, but what we do is we actually have a selection of foams of slightly different acoustic resistance, and the grill on the back as well, which has a scrim on it too, and we control
it. So the output from the back of the panel ideally would be the equivalent to what's coming off the front of the panel, but you have a lot of mechanical stuff back there. You got the frame, you got the motors, you know, you got all this mechanical blockage. So what we're concerned about is reflections off anything mechanical that might come back through the panel. We're also worried about dampening it and decelerating the energy in a practical way. So we have some foam that's more closed cell, some foam that's more open cell. So we've done a lot of testing in terms of trying to, you know, substantially lower the output that way. Because if it's used, like say in this position, and say we were on stage and this was actually in front of us, you might have a live mic here. And you actually, it's very difficult to get these things to go in the feedback, which is a great advantage. But if this thing was completely open, you do you could have a slap off the back coming back at you.
It would be diffused as well, but it would be, but it actually is.
Yeah. It becomes more problematic to have energy going that way, and you know, what do you do with it? And how, and people, you know, who are have monitors on stage, and you know, all sorts of other problems. So we tried to kind of really a cup of tea.
No, a beer.
Okay. oh no, thank you. I'm fine. But yeah, it's actually it's a significant challenge, you know, especially when. We've done some projects where we'll take a bare panel and actually mount it into a standalone structure. And that structure is actually could be on 2x6s, you know, and put it in, just kind of screw it into a frame. And then architects love it because you put a scrim over it, it's gone. And if it's used for voice and presentations like we're doing here, it's a great solution. I think we did, like, since South Carolina, the House of Representatives, and you know, some weird, you know, some where you have some of these old architectures and people are trying to do stuff, and your solution is either some sort of, you know, point source solution that's in a box and has to be intrusive into the room, or kind of use something like this.
So is that in wall, or is it? Or
in that case, it was into a standalone structure that was like floated on top of an existing wall.
So basically. But,
And in some other cases, we've actually looked at architecture where we're putting it into the wall, and again, it's a cutoff frequency now battle, you know. We have to be clever about it, and we have to do a fair amount of modeling to understand what's going to happen, because we don't want to transduce that energy into the structure and then have, you know, have the ceiling shake, you know. But it's completely possible. So for background music, paging, voicing, that sort of thing, it's a great solution. This is like why we have this is like the worst demo room on the planet, if you look at it. We got glass and crap and cement and open roof. And this, you'll get a pretty good sense of how it behaves in here when we turn it on. And that's where it becomes counterintuitive in terms of measurement and what you're listening to. In most rooms, if I had a pair of 12 and horn sitting up here on sticks, we could pretty much figure out, you know, like, don't stand over there and kind of point the box away from the wall and trying to get rid of the side slap. And but it would, the response would be different everywhere in the room. Predictable, but different. And then if we were in a church, the solution to the guy would be, We got to put something on the walls. We got to treat the room somehow, and nobody ever wants to do that. hey, you have a beautiful $3 million house of worship. We need another $500,000 in treatment because we're just never going to get anything to work in this place.
Put drapes over the stained glass window.
There you go. Exactly.
You know.
That's right.
I was going to ask if you actually had calculated your degree of diffusion to minimize the correlation of reflections from some angle or something.
I think that's my next slide.
Oh.
Did you see this beforehand?
Sorry, I haven't done some acoustics in my life.
So, exactly to your...
The ringer in the audience.
Yeah, I know, yeah, yeah. We'll pay you later, okay. So, oh, is it not very clear at the back?
No, I can't see it. But that doesn't matter. I think you could improve my eyesight so I can see.
Hey, Rudy, where's the... Can we hit the light switch real quick?
Yeah, just the
better for us.
Okay, so exactly, we do a cross correlation between the on-axis response and subsequent angles, and we basically, in that correlation, we're comparing the signal at, say, 0 degrees with the signal at 5 degrees, and deriving a coefficient that is a measure of how similar those signals are. So a 1 would be perfectly correlated, and a 0 would be totally uncorrelated. Maybe involves another dimension. I'm not sure. You can? Okay. I've not measured it yet, but I'll look. So on the right-hand side, we have a conventional two-way system. And you can see we've got... So the colours indicate different frequencies. So we go from 250 hertz up to 10 kilohertz. And then along the x-axis, we have the angle from 0 to 70 degrees. And up the y-axis, we have the correlation coefficient. And it's the both scales are the same. They go from 0.3 to 1.1. So you can see that at low on-axis, obviously everything is correlated with itself, as it should be. So at 0 and 0, everything is at the same point. And then as you go up in frequency and start looking across the angles, you see for the conventional system, everything is within a very pretty tight window. Doesn't really drop much below 0.8 at any angle or any frequency. However, for the DML, clearly it's gone bananas. And even for very, very small angles of even 10, 15 degrees, the correlation is dipping below 0.6. And as you go further up and further up in frequency, it's dipping down to 0.3 in some cases. But clearly, these are two very different, very, very different systems. And
to clarify, let's see, exhibits significantly decorrelated output over its radiation coverage.
Yep.
Radiation coverage, is that like the, I guess, the physical space of that?
Yeah, so in this case, we're measuring over, you know, plus or minus 70 degrees. So it's a 140-degree cone that you're looking at, essentially.
Do you also have... I'm assuming you've also done measurements of frequency response versus angle.
Yes. That's coming up as well. Okay. That's coming up shortly.
That's interesting. Because you have to present the average. And the question I was about to ask, I'll now hit again... was if you measured this at different distances,
mm-hmm.
because I know it's going to change some, but I don't know how much.
So yeah, even in the anechoic space, absolutely, because you're getting different contributions from the different parts of the panel because you're different distances away from them. So yeah, it changes with distance as well.
How far is this measuring?
This would have been done at 1.7 meters. So definitely in the far field.
Yeah, go to the next one.
Yep. So this is kind of everything all in one. So what we're looking at here is 50 hertz to 20 kilohertz. And then on the vertical axis, 0 degrees in the center. And we're going to plus or minus 90 degrees at the top and bottom. And then the color is on a 50 dB scale. And that's showing level. So what you can see, and this was measured in our anechoic chamber, and we actually at the time we didn't have an infinite baffle, we just had a fixed finite baffle. And so just in this region here, that's the effect of the baffle. So what you see is from sort of somewhat just below 100 hertz up to just over 5 kilohertz, you've got almost 170, 165 degrees of wide coverage, wide and even coverage. When you get to about 5.5, 6K, it does narrow down to a narrower region of about plus or minus 60 degrees, so 120 degrees.
And this is an old panel.
And this is what you're going to hear.
Yeah. That's right.
And so the reason, so we are obviously looking to do a full range DML, take it all the way up. You can actually run the DML full range. It sounds great. It just lacks some of the side fill, which we're working on. But one of the main reasons why we didn't kind of push it in the very first time was because this was the first time anyone had put this much power into a DML. And Marcelo and I were working on the design, and we knew that as a pro audio product, if this fails on, you know, when someone's on stage, you know, people, they're never going to trust us again. So we had to make it absolutely bomb-proof. And so we made some very conservative engineering choices, as I say, because it was the first time anyone had really tried to do this. So, yes, you know, can we do a full-range, full-wide directivity design? The answer is yes. We're working on it at the moment, and we're pretty close. But what you're going to hear today, because of those choices that we made, we engineered a ribbon to take over. Well, Marcelo engineered a ribbon to take over from here, from 5K upwards. So the directivity of the ribbon is more constrained in the vertical direction.
And then the key in terms of system design is that you don't have a crossover sitting at 2K. And we've moved the crossover way on towards the top. And has much less of a, let's say, audible influence on what you need, you know, what you need to worry about. You basically have no crossover in the vocal region. And that was one of the characteristics, or one of the features of using a DML for something like this, that was going to be really important. I'll do the next slide, I guess.
Yep. So actually, so that's the end of our kind of brief kind of coverage of DML. So I'm now going to talk about BMR, or the balanced mode radiator. So again, the BMR was kind of first conceived at NXT, and the idea was we wanted to have a drive unit that you could basically drop in and tune the low frequency alignment just like you would do with a conventional system, but it has benefits of much wider directivity and a single acoustic source. And again, as Marcelo just mentioned, with the BMR as well, we eliminate the crossover from the most critical part of the audio band.
And then here you can actually use Teal's small parameters to try to figure out a system design, and the other one you can't.
Yeah. So this, essentially, you treat this just like any other kind of speaker that you're aligning into an enclosure, but you also have the knowledge that you don't have to cross it over to a tweeter. There's just no need for that. So how does it work? So you can see here on the left-hand side, it's moving like a piston. And on the right-hand side, at the higher frequency, it's bending. It is actually also moving like a piston here too. So it's taking a superposition of the modes. And by the modes, I include the zero mode or the piston mode. So you have any frequency is always the sum of all of the lower modes below that. The basic idea of BMR is actually going back to what we would call, or what we would be taught in an acoustics course. One of the first things you look at is solving the equations for a circular disc, a free circular disc in a baffle, in an infinite baffle. And when you do that, what you find is that disc has completely perfectly flat on-axis SPL and an extremely flat, smooth sound power response. So it's kind of like almost the ideal acoustic target. The problem is that you can't realize that because by definition it's a free disc. It has nothing driving it. So in reality, you have to attach a voice coil. And then in doing so, you add mass and you break the lovely behavior of that free disc. And that free disc is modal. It has modes in it. And that's, again, those modes are key to why it has the smooth power response and the flat on-axis pressure and everything. So when you put the mass, the voice coil on to drive this object, I say you destroy that lovely behavior. And what we figured out was that you can actually recover that behavior by rebalancing for the mass that you've added. And I'm going to show you a little bit more about how that works.
Is this something like a snare drum head, those kind of modes, or tom-tom kind of?
Sort of, but different. So a snare drum is constrained around the edge.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a clamped condition at the edge. This BMR is very much free at the edge. And in fact, you find in any object like this, the edge is always an antinode. And if you don't want to disturb that modal structure, the last thing you should be doing is putting something on the edge. And you'll find that the roll surrounds that we put on the BMRs never go on the very edge. They go slightly inboard of the edge, so that the very edge is always free. So, what do we do? So, the way of kind of looking at a BMR is you need to look at the admittance of the disc, and the admittance is the inverse of the mechanical impedance. It's just a fancy word for that. So what you find is that if we look across the disc, I'm sorry, this is a very small image. You find you have the first mode, you have the second mode, which has two dips, the third mode, which has three dips. And what the engineers and scientists at NXT realized was that if you balance one of the higher modes, you automatically fix all of the lower modes. And this is the thing that was so counterintuitive, because most of the time engineers had started at the beginning. They'd started at you've got the piston mode, okay, and then we've got the first bending mode, and in the prior art there's ways of dealing with that. You put your voice coil on the first nodal line and then you don't drive the first mode. Simple. So you extend the bandwidth of your drive unit just by doing that. That's great. The problem is that the nodal line for the first mode is very close to the antinode of the second mode. And so you don't drive the first mode, but you drive the second mode hugely. So it's like breakup in a cone. You know, you get this massive uncontrolled kind of whang. So engineers who'd looked at this previously had kind of got to the first mode and gone, we can fix the first mode, couldn't go any further. And it was actually looking at it from the other end, and it's like looking at the admittance curves and going, well, actually, when you look at the shape of these curves, if I was to draw a line from these two outer edges coming down, they would actually center on the center of this one. And on this third mode one here, these two would center onto that one, and these two would center onto that one, and the two outer ones come together onto this guy. And so by positioning your coil at one of these locations and your balancing masses at the other locations, you're actually fully balancing all of the modes, or the target modes in that panel. Now, for the BMR, we're typically looking at up to four modes at the most in the audible range. So it's not a DML. It's very different from a DML. It doesn't have we wouldn't call it a predominantly diffuse radiator. It's a different kind of class of object, but it has a whole load of other benefits in other areas. The fact that it can just drop into a box and can do low frequencies as well. But clearly both radiators come from a bending wave kind of understanding.
So this is actually interesting. So here is, you want to talk really counterintuitive. You make a measurement for one of these devices and you go, oh my God, I got this average hole right here. Wait, I can fix it. Let's add mass. Huh? And by adding mass, boom, the energy comes right back. Any audio device I've ever been around my whole life does not work that way.
Yeah, it's kind of strange.
Yeah, completely.
Oh, what, sorry?
A lossy
you
medium.
Use a lossy medium so that maybe you get less propagation high frequencies.
No, I mean we don't want anything lossy really, because we want to maximize all of the efficiency.
It was occurring to me that it also had a lossy medium, and also in addition to changing the size of the radiator and moving the nodal points at higher frequencies.
Yep. So there is, I mean, there's a company, they're called Manga, who make a transducer. They also claim, you know, based on bending wave ideas. And what they do is they actually terminate everything at the edges. I heard it many, many years ago, and it sounded okay. But it's been a lot. Yeah, it's probably been 15 years since I heard it, so I couldn't give you any useful information there. But yeah, that's a different approach. But absolutely, they terminate. They try and terminate everything. It has like a star shaped edge on the surround.
Mm-hmm. Propagating, but in the back, to talk about a lattice of the structure, like a truss network, mm-hmm. to distribute the force of the driver of the coil. Mm-hmm. So instead of exciting the plate in a circle,
yep.
it spreads it out. It's like a footing.
Yeah,
we have some devices in production that can show you that actually use something like that.
I know most of these guys are electrical engineers, but I actually come from a civil engineering background. Mm.
Yeah, we have a voice coil structure that actually blows up and has we're trying to drive a modal line that's actually has a larger diameter. The problem is that we actually use this contraption.
But then your coil gains mass, right?
Yes, it does.
I was going to add a sparse but structurally efficient network behind the plate that the coil drives that distributes the coil force out into the plate evenly.
But you don't want to do that.
What's that?
You don't want to do that because in doing so, you'd make it a piston. You'd make it rigid.
Oh, so you don't want this?
We don't want it to be rigid. We want the modes. The modes are key to this.
We're back to the modes again.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry.
Maybe you shouldn't be exciting with a voice coil. Maybe there's another way.
One of the areas where we can actually put mass and actually put the voice coil and put other balancing masses, it's all a proportion of the diameter of the disc. So we know exactly where we need to, what modes are going to be generated, which one, first, second, third, or fourth. And in the case of the structure I'm describing was, if the ideal mode becomes, or the mode we want to drive, you might end up having a 90 millimeter disc and an 81 millimeter coil, you know, something crazy, where the coil structure is way too big, has much too mass, and very expensive. So but that's the one that we want to drive. So what we might do is go to a smaller mode.
Driving it at the edges of the disc?
No. So the largest we would go is probably about 70% of the diameter.
Okay.
Yeah.
So and what we end up with is having a smaller voice coil structure, and then actually building something that will drive that ideal mode. And we know exactly what the diameter of that mode, where the diameter of that voice coil needs to be, or that additional material needs to be at.
Question. How important is material selection in the diaphragm versus your DMLs panels?
How important is the material selection?
Absolutely. When you're designing the BMR, you know, you're looking, you want to have a certain number of modes in band. And that depends upon what kind of directivity you want and what the bandwidth is. So absolutely, you'll be looking at a material, you'll be looking at different thicknesses of panel, looking at different materials, for example. And again, all of them, you want to have a good timbre. You want it to sound natural and not add any coloration of its own. So it's not, I'd say it's probably a little bit simpler than the DML, because with the BMR, you're only concerned about radial modes. So it's only really a one-dimensional problem. Whereas the DML, by definition, is a two-dimensional modal structure. And actually that goes when you're modeling. So when you're modeling a BMR in FEA or whatever package you're using, you can model a BMR virtually, you can do it axisymmetric. So you model it on a 2D plane that gets revolved in the software, essentially. So it keeps your mesh and everything very, very efficient. And you're exploiting the rotational symmetry of your structure to do that. With a DML, it's deliberately asymmetric. Your excitation positions are definitely not on the center. They're off center. Everything is asymmetric, and intentionally so.
Can you put one of these in a computer monitor, for instance, maybe have an OLED on front? Mm-hmm. So you have like all of the of your other kind of these guys?
I mean, we used to call it SoundView, and we'd put a like an acrylic screen across the front of a display screen. And we would actually, there are solutions for drive points on the edge, and we would drive the screen. And then you'd see the image from behind, and it was great for locking the speech and everything to the picture. You have a bandwidth limitation because you have typically you don't want to add too much depth to your product. So you have a very, very thin air region behind the panel. And so eventually the stiffness of the air load limits your low frequencies. So you typically need to add a bass driver. And by the time you've done that, in most TV companies are like, well, actually, you've quadrupled my costs, so no thank you. What we did do was, so when I said that BMR is like a one-dimensional problem, so you can actually take that disc and you can take a slice out of it, and you can make a one-dimensional, a beam, essentially, very, very narrow in one direction. And we call that a HARP, a high aspect ratio panel BMR. And we sold millions of those many, many years ago to companies like Vizio and ViewSonic. And again, because of the wide directivity, you could even place them down firing and still get good HF out here, not just in front of it there.
Sony has a panel now that where they're vibrating LG screen.
Piezos.
Yeah. No, no, no. They use voice coil.
Same technique.
They use the voice coil motors. Yeah. Yeah. I can't comment too much more on that. So
this is all making me think about plate tectonics. Like
that's the idea.
Share a lot of technology with that field.
I personally haven't delved into that. I mean, I've looked there a little bit, and
this is what they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's analogies with the S&P waves that you get in earthquakes. Absolutely,
and they have really sophisticated models about how the plates will respond to being edge driven by a sudden jolt in one point.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, no, what's
going on
with
that?
Earthquakes, the epicenter
of
the window.
Yeah, it's not our fault.
The whole Pacific Northwest is going to become one of these.
I don't know.
We'll try and avoid any natural disasters. So, just summarising the BMR approach here. So you've got your theoretical ideal of the free disc, lovely flat response. You add your voice coil and you destroy that lovely flat response, but you can add your masses, your rings of mass, to rebalance for that.
And those are on the surface or just behind the surface of the disc?
They're just on the rear side of the disc. And obviously the roll surround forms one of those rings. And we position the roll surround inboard from the edge, and we adjust the thickness of the flange where it glues to the disc to give us the right mass. And so we save an extra component in that way.
Those rings, those are actually pretty modest in mass.
Yeah, so they scale off the voice coil. Everything scales from the voice coil mass. So often we try and use the lightest coil possible because all of the other masses we have to add scale from that. Absolutely, yeah.
Have you measured or theorized about something other than frequency response amplitude that's happening when you are controlling the modes with the circular maps that you're adding the ring masses that you're adding? Anything else about we'll probably get over into the kind of stuff that you think about with the DML, how the wavefronts coincide further out from the driver and so forth? Has there been any modeling of that? There's some stuff that happens on the hobby side, local guy, but Purvine treats drivers with he does it by tap testing and listening and whatever, and adds little bits of mass to the cone, and you can hear very interesting differences. The sound gets a lot clearer.
Definitely.
But I was wondering if you theorized about how those effects come about.
Yeah, I mean, you see some of it because we use an anisotropic panel, for example, for our BMR as well. So you'd think, okay, so that's a little bit strange. But again, the voice coil is forcing everything to be axisymmetric. The fact that you have the dominant structure that you're sticking to the panel is circular, and then the roll surround, less mechanically dominant, but it's still important, that's circular symmetric. But on the larger panels, sometimes you can see a small effect due to the anisotropy. And what you can do is you can put some little pieces of, like little pieces of rubber or something, just to shift the modes, or shift that, because it's not about the stiffness or the mass, it's about the stiffness mass ratio. And again, if you can just put a little bit of mass in the right location, you can shift that back and make it look closer to an isotropic disc again. And again, what the gentleman you're referring to is possibly doing is, again, he's changing that modal structure. And perhaps he's generating some modes that sound, euphonic or something. Or
they're generating the right types of harmonics that you find very pleasant, And that could be part of also not only the wet and the mass, but also a combination of the mass and the material that the cone's made out of. That's typically where you see the highest deviation, let's say, Worst material we can use is polycarbonate cone. Very nicely damped, very, very neutral, measures neutrally, blah, 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 blah. But it's kind of uninspiring. You know, we would never use a polycarbonate cone for a guitar speaker, right? Because the guy, we were just talking earlier, well, he's not here. Because the guitar speaker is quite the opposite. You know, it's this device that is generating really pleasant harmonics. Just the cone structure itself. You measure it and it just looks awful. You know, it's just got all this noise and stuff, but you play through it and the guy goes, oh, I love that. It's got this crunch or it's got this thickness. And you're able to change the parameters of on the conventional speaker, those parameters, by just messing around with masses and getting the cone to ring a certain way or bend a certain way at a given frequency. And in those areas where the human ear is very sensitive to that stuff, you really pick that up. I mean, if it happens between 800 and, you know, 4K, boom, you'll hear it, you know? And again, that's probably what's happening with this particular guy. And it's kind of counterintuitive as well. You know, you can get like more ringing out of this cone by adding mass.
I'd love to take one of the ones, let's say before he does his treatment, and we measure it, and we measure the power response and everything, and then we take the treated one and measure and see in the power what's going on. That would be fascinating.
I know a gentleman right down in Juanita.
Oh, really?
What he does basically is a tremendous amount of empirical testing using his ear and, you know, lots of iterations. And I say he's more of an artist, you know, in the sense that he's or a master chef, where he sits there and very meticulously does these testings into his ear, and he gets some good results that way.
I hate those guys. it's great. That's totally correct. Like, hate those guys. They drive me crazy. Why does it sound so good?
That's why I was wondering if you guys have figured out a way to measure some of that stuff. He figures it's a lot of it's happening where the wavefronts kind of coincide out in front of the driver.
I mean, you probably get, there is a degree of secondary radiation from the waves encountering a discontinuity in the panel that might cause a secondary radiation effect to occur that would cause some interference effect in front of the panel, perhaps.
Or he's controlling that. I can't remember exactly. I'm closing us about turbine.
Oh, okay. I'd love to. Yeah, I live in Juanita myself, so.
Oh God, yeah, certainly.
So I have to meet him.
I can put you in touch with him. He's a
thank you.
Very
I'd love.
Interesting guy.
I'd love to. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, nice man.
Is that going to be April's meeting? The meeting of these guys?
I think we should move along. Yes. We're going to be here till midnight.
Single driver speakers, one pair of which they're identical, one pair of which he's modified, one pair not. And he set them up once at the Pacific Northwest Audio Society. And the difference was just amazing. I mean, you could just hear better with the modified.
The name was called Onetics.
Yeah. Onetics.
Very transformers.
Thank you. That would be great. Okay, so just to kind of give you a little bit of proof in the pudding, I guess. Here's a measurement of one of our BMRs. This is a 3-inch BMR. We call it the BMR 46. It's a 46 millimeter diameter panel. So what you can see, the red curve is the on-axis SPL. there's a dip at 400 again due to our finite baffle. Nothing to do with the speaker whatsoever. So this operates from about 100, it's about minus 60 dB, is about 100, 102 or something, and it goes to beyond 20 kilohertz. It's good for about 20 watts power handling. And, you know, there's a number of embodiments that we're looking at with this device where we might put it into something where we do cross over with a bass driver, but we'll cross over at 300 hertz. And then we'll get more power into the BMR. And yeah, it could form the basis of a great two-way system. But actually,
try a pair of these for your neck bit.
Oh,
these little guys. Yeah,
that looks good.
And you can see on the blue curve, that's the sound power response over plus or minus 90 degrees. And again, it's not just the fact that it's you know, very flat and extended, but also the fact it has no major anomalies. There's a little wobble coming in at just under 18.5K.
at any given, any individual direction off axis to you, right? There's no anomalies either?
There's nothing nasty. I mean, you see little wobbles and stuff, but nothing, there's no, nothing like a breakup mode. Nothing that's uncontrolled or would really stick out. Absolutely. You know, it's yeah, that's the feature, is very controlled.
So is your next slide going to be the distortion of this measurement?
My next slide is probably my last slide, and I don't think it's very exciting, unfortunately.
So how is this driven? Driven with a normal power amp audio?
Yep, just it's a 4 ohm, 8 ohm, regular load. Yep.
There's no massive multi pre-processing.
No.
Could something like that be used to tune these?
Sure.
In electronic ways rather than the mechanical ways you're using?
So you can, that's a good question, and it's something that we talk about a little bit, is that you can apply DSP and all kinds of EQ that you want to a speaker, but you, in applying that, you apply it over all angles. So if you've got an anomaly on axis that's a 6 dB peak or somewhere, you put a 6 dB notch, and that's great. You fixed it on axis, but now you've got a notch.
Unless
all these other angles.
This guy over here splatters paint.
Right.
It sound better.
Right. So what we're doing is we're fixing the sound of the drive unit in the mechanics before we, you know. So we're kind of fixing the problem at its source. You can then apply DSP on top of this and EQ on top of it if you want to refine the balance and everything.
Right.
But we want to deliver you a drive unit that sounds, you know, predominantly it's flat and smooth and controlled at all angles.
Just hook it up where the other speaker was and it works better.
Yeah.
Or you can use 49 little cheap drivers and a lot of
DSP. You could, but you still wouldn't get away from the fact that you've got to have lots of interference between those drivers.
Well, that's you use the interference, just like you use the
NAT. Well, that's in our DML.
What?
So that's the DML.
Yeah.
But I'm, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, you could do it in the DML. But yeah, a load of complex processing. You may not get all of the features, though.
It's the same filter design problem.
I understand.
It's the same filter design program. The thing is, you also get the shade and stuff, which can be useful for.
And will they do low frequencies as well?
Reasonably well. I mean, it's the same. Basically, you get the same behavior, but you do it in a different way.
Sure.
Because you get it to the point where you're actually seeing differences in the acoustic loading in the middle. So you're basically seeing on the fly changes in the acoustic space.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you make an array, absolutely.
What kind of efficiencies do you get from these DMLs as compared to conventional loudspeakers?
So our DML in this device here it's about 94 dB, 1 watt, 1 meter, I believe. It's not like a 105 dB compression loaded, horn loaded monster. But again, it's probably putting the sound out in a more natural and probably putting energy into the room in different areas.
Now you have to actually take in consideration the differences between sensitivity and efficiency. So when people look at sensitivity, they're looking, oh man, it's 102 dB, 1 watt, 1 meter. Well, it's measured on axis, 1 meter away. But now if you look at the power response or the acoustic power response, if it's loaded on a 90, let's say a 90 by 60 horn, which is a pretty wide horn, you still have substantial roll-off in both the horizontal and vertical plane. You compare power response measurements, and this is actually substantially more efficient than a conventional device. And we're typically loading a panel with 600 watts. That's what we're recommending, typically, 600 to 800 watts into the load. And because it's also behaving more like a resistive load, we have relatively small movement. We don't have a lot of the nasty stuff that's occurring inside the magnetic structure that you'll typically see in a speaker that's got a coil moving, let's say 12 millimeters, one way. We're basically moving these things 3 millimeters, 4 millimeters.
At the most. At the very most, yeah.
So you don't have a lot of the strange, complex EMF coming back to this amplifier. It creates a very, very friendly load for a given amplifier channel.
The maximum phase you're driving people to?
Oh gosh, I think it's around 40 degrees.
The maximum phase angle.
Yeah.
Oh, I couldn't tell off the top of my head.
I've seen it.
Yeah, we could.
Above your base retinas, of course. But can't avoid
it. Mm. So what is the impedance?
So these guys, this is an 8-ohm.
So, mm-hmm.
so we've got four exciters. Each exciter is 8 ohms, wide in series parallel. And so you see...
Just treat them as an 8-ohm load.
Just treat it as an 8-ohm load. And it's, let's say it's predominantly resistive in the mechanical domain, but that reflects back into the electrical domain as well.
Where does the 8 ohms come from? I mean, is that manufactured as part of the process? Could that be high impedance?
We can do whatever you like. I mean, we design the coil... in just the same way you design a coil for a regular drive unit.
I think I can, if I can see the wire, I can make you a 600 ohm. I have to find it.
Could you use this in headphones?
Can't say right now.
I think this
you're going to see, let's just say, next year you're going to see a local Seattle Northwest company have an interesting application of this technology and something like that.
This will make a nice I got these K240s from yesteryear, you know. They're still my favorite headphones. They just sound good. And it's the multi-transducer. Yeah.
I don't think we have enough NDA forms for everybody to sign.
Take the great support.
Yeah.
I'm curious how the BMRs compare with the full range speakers out there for DIY, is it a similar type of technology or completely different? I don't know much about the full range speakers. So
most conventional full range speakers take a number of approaches. They either try and make the diaphragm extremely stiff and push all of the modes out of the band. And so you're either looking at kind of exotic materials or very, very small transducers. The other approach, and typically it's a metal-type diaphragm, so as soon as you go outside of the target band, you have the first mode is like ping, of like 16 dB or something. The other approach is to have a very heavily damped cone. So there are going to be breakup modes, and they just accept that, and typically off-axis, they look pretty nasty and sound pretty nasty. So those are the two that I've typically seen.
You have somebody, that, like, say, for... We worked with Rode Microphones for 7 years, and we ended up having to design loudspeakers that ended up being reference boxes so we could actually calibrate microphones on production lines. And you end up using something like the 4-inch from Fostex, which is a really nice sounding little, and it's using, I think some sort of banana leaf as the source to make the cone, and you can see all the handwork on the cone, and you measure it, and it measures okay, It's very nice sounding, but you can't put any power into it.
And it's very expensive as well.
And it's really expensive. It's about $300, I think, for a little 4-inch.
They're not really designing it mathematically like...
No.
How much are these typically?
So you'll find some of our smaller ones are a few dollars, and some of our larger ones are... $5 to $10 in volume. And
how about a pair of these if I took it to my studio?
Oh, the DMLs?
Sure.
Oh. Please contact our sales team for pricing.
Talk to those guys. I don't know.
Is there a sort of a range? Are they 1,000, 2,000, 10,000, 500, 200?
Those are the MSRP, if there is such a thing. $7,500 for each one of those. And that includes the ribbon, which we haven't talked much about, but that's called a PL11, which means one DML and one ribbon. And then if you look at some of the pictures here, you're going to see a longer panel, and that's a PL12. It has two DMLs and one ribbon.
And that's a piece, not a pair?
Right, that's a piece, and then you have to DSP and amplification and add a subwoofer.
Yeah, so really expensive for these, but I think in the next 9 months... you'll see what we're working on is going to literally more than cut that price in half.
Are they materially lighter? Is there something about them that makes the install?
Well, first of all, you don't need. You kind of go that way.
Right.
So we're not trying to do a line array which has to be precisely pointed and then
weigh. What's it weigh?
72 pounds for that one. The bigger ones are just under.
So they're lighter than a conventional.
So they're relatively light compared to what we're competing against. And the rigging is an ATM tube type rigging with connector bars, so you can put arrays in if you want to. Actually, that's something Mike knows about because he does a lot of production work. And he has a set of PL12s, a 4-and-4. And he's got a 4-and-4 in what we call toasters. And then he also has some of the smaller setups, so he can go in and do other production with the smaller ones.
You basically roll the flight case underneath the lift or whatever you're going to put, and you lower the thing down, you connect one in, you raise it up, connect the next one on, if you want to stack them, make an array of them.
If you put them in an array, is there conventional array-like things going on?
No.
Or there is, so they're just
more. It's just more acoustic.
Bigger,
they don't really couple.
Pretty much, yes.
Right? Yeah, it becomes literally a wall.
Yeah, actually, we see basically more output in the bottom end because they tend to couple.
And the baffle.
In the baffle.
So
yeah, but they don't have the same sort of predictable interaction that you would have with multiple horns or multiple mid-ranges. They just don't. They don't have the combing effects that you typically see. You end up having just more acoustic power available.
What is the maximum SPL? Now, I know you're talking about power output, yeah. Which obviously.
Yeah, but we've measured in we've done things like everything from measuring something in the anechoic to I hate doing this sort of work because the one of the challenges that you have is you have someone who's going to take the panel and apply their own DSP and their own amplification. And I don't know what that is. And we try to do as much as we can with the applications in terms of making suggestions. We provide DSP files for whatever processor, whether it's RAIN or Lake or BSS or whatever. We try to, you know, give them. And part of that is actually looking at maximum power input, power output that we want to see going into. And all that has to be calculated, because if it's being done in the way I'm describing, it has to be done calculated in the controller side of it. And that's really iffy because at the end of the day, we don't know what is the voltage level coming out of the amplifier channel. You know, that's what you really want to control, is being able to limit there. And basically look at the peak and either do a fast limiter and kind of cut the peak off, or look at some time constant and look at the overall average RMS power. So it becomes a challenge for us because at the end of the day, we're not an electronics company. So we have to kind of like play by these realities in the marketplace. But that being said, because of the way it behaves, we're crossing over at 100 hertz. You know, I've hit these things with close to 2 kilowatts, and I've yet to blow them up above 100 hertz. And in the field, I don't know, we've been at it for 4 years now.
Yeah,
I think we've had one panel, two panels.
Usually it's because they don't put the high pass.
Okay, so that being said, we measured anywhere between 125 to 128.
Yeah.
Okay. Under those conditions,
max power, and then keep...
1 meter. That would be 1 meter?
1 meter.
1 meter.
But you're talking about one.
Yeah, one panel.
One panel.
And then from there, you basically have... when you're hitting that sort of SPL level, it's a different effect than, you know, we did. I'll describe to you a couple of early, and don't look at me that way, because he's going, oh God, he's going to say it, you know. All right, so one of the I heard this at a offsite demo in NAMM, going to be 5 years ago, come this January, and I did this. So Dave Firestone called me up and said, Marcelo, I'm working with this technology and it's new and blah blah blah, and I went harumph, you know, what new? Flat panel? Oh God, no! I went to the demo, and by the time five years ago means that I had been doing at that time I had been doing this for 25 years, and I've heard every demo on the planet, and I'll show you guys how I behave in those demos. When I listen, do I go to the demo? The first thing I do is look at a signal chain. What are they using as a music source? What are they going to be using for a mixer? What are they using for a DSP? What are they using for an amplifier? What are they using for a power source in the wall? Because all of those things have an influence as to what you're going to experience in here in 5 minutes. So these guys were doing it all wrong. iPhone, Personas cheap thing up front, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, oh, God. Okay. So... the demo starts, and what I'm listening to, I'm like, I sat there and I said, I was just thinking this. I'm going, this sounds like NXT. So I wonder if these guys know that it sounds like NXT, because it's probably NXT inside. And I couldn't see what was inside of it. It was like this. I couldn't see anything. But I took him outside and I said, what do you want me to be your friend? I'll tell you the truth. You know, I go, it sounds like NXT. Be careful. They're very litigious. I don't know what's inside of there, number one. Number two, it has this sort of hi-fi sound, like hi-fi, which is wrong for what you want for front of house. You know, because here's the difference. And we did this demo probably a year later with Dave Ratt. We rented a theater in Ventura. We had Ratt Sound come in. They hung Anel Acoustics. They put in the mixer I wanted up front. And we did a comparison in this really old, empty theater with just all sorts of weird architecture, blah, blah, blah. And that was still the old rev of these panels. It was a very, very early sort of, it's getting this thing to evolve. And I wanted to prove a point. And the point was, at front of house, I can get the L acoustics right here to just sound exactly the way I wanted it to do. It was up front. It was transparent. It had kick. You know, when that guy hit the snare drum in that recording, boom, I heard... Okay, that's live sound. Problem is, I move 3 feet this way, it's a different experience. I move towards the back of the wall, I could hear the slap. Towards the side of the wall, you hear that massive slap coming off the side as you're walking up and down the side aisles. Go to the balcony, no high end. So, okay, now let's turn ours up. And ours says it was really different. We could get a character that was closer to what we wanted, but it was everywhere and it was the same. And so, you know, of course, Dave Ratt, you know, was like, oh my god, what's going on? Yeah, you know, and he just couldn't get the guy to shut up. But by the way, that was my first job. I worked for Dave Ratt when I was 16 years old, being a roadie in Southern California doing punk shows.
Well, that's how you got him to do it.
Well, actually, if you go on Dave's website, he has a collection of, I don't know if you've ever seen this, he's got a collection of flyers from all of the shows, and there must be hundreds of flyers. This is how we communicated back then, right? Flyer, flyer, flyer. And I had 14 flyers he didn't have. So, if you do this for me, I'll give you the flyers. Okay, we'll do it. But that was the first time that I had experienced it in a controlled situation like that. And then it was a matter of SPL. And the one thing that is telling is when you get close to the edge with these panels, now you're driving peak. Okay, now we're talking about peak power, but we're getting into peak voltages that are turning into 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, and then all of a sudden it'll go boom, we just lost the motor. There is no warning whatsoever where you drive you're driving the element into distortion, into audible distortion, and you kind of like back off the fader. No, you backed off and the distortion's really low. And that's one thing that was also very counterintuitive. I couldn't in my head connect the dots in terms of, okay, the measurement is kind of fuzzy on axis, but why is the distortion so low? I don't get it. You know, it was, well, there's no spider, well, there's no surround, and there's no elements that are actually creating those sorts of, you know, there's nothing to generate the typical audible distortion that you listen to in a normal loudspeaker.
It's like excursion. Your car sneaking up on you.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
So what did Dave Ratt think?
Dave basically said, he started getting it. He said, there's so many corporate applications where I can use this thing. I can just hang it and walk away. And do they come in white? Yes, they come in white. Okay, great. So you know, so he's kind of, you know, he
wasn't going to take him on the road for high level.
Absolutely, no, you know, at the end of the day, we talk a lot about, you know, we have fellows like Savvy Sound using it and stuff. There's lots of reasons why I don't think that's personally. I don't think that's really where you want to use this type of technology. I think there's so many applications for it in environments like the one we're sitting in right now, where you have lots of reflective surfaces, lots of complex architectures that don't allow you to treat the room, where they're perfect. You know, I started a company called KV2 back in 2002 after I left Mackie, and I can tell you from very painful personal experience how difficult it is to get on writers. That has nothing to do with your product. It's just like how much money you want to throw at it. You know, either giving gear away or convincing people to try to use it. And at the end of the day, it's a very politically charged environment because of those relationships that are out there. And if you want to do it, great, good luck. You know, but you know, I've got friends like at Vue that I don't know how many millions of dollars they've thrown at it over the last 6 years. And after millions and millions spent all over the planet, they're finally getting some traction. But that, you know, I think it's probably not the right way to kind of approach it. You know, what I'm kind of inside of Tectonic, what I'm a big advocate of is let's find a problem and let's solve it. You know, just because we have this flat panel technology doesn't mean that we're like the solution for all of live sound's problems. But certainly there's plenty of problems we can solve. And some of the things that we're doing now locally, for example, we have someone back there that's gotten us into actually being able to do intelligibility studies inside CTAC. That's a really cool thing that we could actually go and explore. And because there's lots of, you know, I was just in London last month, man, and you know, you go to King's Cross train station and their solution, it's considering the problem, it's as good as it's going to get. And it's basically a line array, just a big pole, and this thing's massive. It's probably 24 feet high, hung on the wall, and they fire it through the middle of the train station. And if you're getting off the train and you're walking towards the exit, you're seeing that array pointed at you, and you have other arrays that are put on a delay in poles with LED displays on top. So as you're walking to the pole, it's getting louder, louder, louder. Walk beyond the pole, it gets lower, lower, lower until you get to the next one. But there's so many modes inside this old iron and brick station, you're never going to solve the problem unless you change the architecture. And there's never going to be any other solution. So, hey, somebody call the guys who run the train stations in London and the tube stations and the British Airport Authority. Let's do some intelligibility studies. Because this actually is a very, very good solution for something like that.
I can hear that.
You know, so I think those are the types of things that we're doing. And what we're going to show you guys now is we're showing you these two pieces, which we've done. The panels themselves are like in restaurants in Seattle. And we have these in some hotels in Seattle. We're all over the country, but we have plenty of stuff local. And then we're working on some prototype embodiments of like ceiling speakers. And we're doing lots of car audio projects. We're working... You can name the guys, or do stuff.
Oh, well,
Bentley.
Bentley, absolutely, yeah.
You know, what's the new one? The big SUV.
So the Bentayga wasn't quite the first, but it was the first big one where it has 9 of our BMRs in it, and I think now the Continental and the GT. I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Nothing in the Hi-Fi.
Okay. There's a number of companies back in the UK that use it.
Boston Acoustics have done a range.
Yeah.
Boston Acoustics is doing something with this. Mm-hmm. It's moderately priced.
Yeah, yeah, just a floor stander, I think, and maybe a stand bookshelf as well.
It includes the bottom end.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a conventional bass driver and a BMR, you know, used kind of mid-HF, I think.
What's the other guy? The guy who makes the ceiling speakers.
Oh, Cambridge Audio.
Cambridge Audio uses it.
Oh, really?
There's a few of the UK guys are using it.
There's some esoteric UK guys that are using it.
I need a solution for my son because he has an apartment that's a lot worse than this room.
Cool.
It's like this room. Actually, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
Is he here?
Hard walls, concrete top and bottom. No, and everything's parallel surfaces, and it's just the whole apartment is 15 by 70. So his living dining room area is one big rectangle that's reflected. We put on a movie, I can't understand any of the dialogue, no matter where I'm standing.
We'll show you. In the other building, we actually have a UK company that makes a soundbar using the stuff, and we have a Everything in the office got one for Christmas last year.
He spent a small fortune on this system, and I can't understand a word.
We got to get moving, right?
Let's get we got to get moving. So what we're going to ask you guys to do is, if everybody would fold up a chair, that'd be really helpful, because we want you to be able to walk when we're doing this demo. We want you to be able to cruise the whole room. That's part of your demo.
Move this over here.
And the way this is going to work is, we're going to do a demo here for pretty much everybody at once, and then we'll split into two groups.
Can we just disconnect?
We got to remember to take this home tonight.